There is a possibility that election issues may come before the Supreme Court in the days following the election, and all the more reason why we should have 9 justices on the Supreme Court.
Didn't seem to care so much about that back in 2016, did you?
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Issues could have come before the court then. But only now, for some reason.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair. And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs. Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
Yep.
Yes, I'm stuck in the middle.
From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is The Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in Red Bluff and Redding, California, on KFOI, Round Mountains, KKRN, and Eureka's KGOE. In Oregon, on the Central Coast, on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW. In Lancaster, Pennsylvania, on WLRI, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU. In Columbus, Ohio, on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP. In New Orleans on WHIV, Gallup, New Mexico's KNIZ, in Concord, New Hampshire on WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, up in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internets. On the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, FYI Nation, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, Workforce Rising, No Lies Radio, Deprogrammed Radio, Bird and Square Radio, and Detour Talk. Blanketing Planet Earth 5 days a week. I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for another all-too-thrilling edition of The Bradcast. Glad to have you here. A Kentucky grand jury on Wednesday has indicted a single former police officer for shooting into neighboring apartments, but did not move forward with charges against any officers for their role in Breonna Taylor's shooting death by police officers in the middle of the night as she was sleeping in her own apartment on March 13th of this year in Louisville. The grand jury announced that fired officer Brett Hankison was charged with 3 counts of wanton endangerment in connection to the police raid of Taylor's home, in which cops broke open the door for a drug raid in a case of essentially mistaken identity. No drugs were found in her apartment, and her boyfriend, a licensed gun owner who woke up terrified as the police entered in the middle of the night, fired his weapon once in self-defense before police then fired 10 times, killing Taylor, a 36-year-old African-American emergency medical specialist, in the bargain. It took some time for the killing of Taylor to become widely known nationally. It occurred amid the national uprisings earlier this year against the police killing of George Floyd in Minneapolis. Immediately after Wednesday's announcement about the charges, or lack thereof, in Louisville, many expressed frustration that the grand jury did not do more. Linda Sarsour of Until Freedom, a group that has pushed for charges in this case, tweeted, "Justice has not been served." She called for people to rise up everywhere for Breonna Taylor. Attorney Ben Crump, who is representing Taylor's family, tweeted that the charges involved, quote, "nothing for the murder of Breonna Taylor. This is outrageous and offensive," he said. At a news conference, the state attorney general, Daniel Cameron, said Hankison and the 2 other officers who entered Taylor's apartment announced themselves before entering the apartment and did not use a no-knock warrant. According to Kentucky law, the use of force by the officers was justified to protect themselves, said Cameron. "This justification bars us from pursuing criminal charges in Miss Breonna Taylor's death," the AG said. Regarding the inevitable disappointment by those who wanted criminal charges brought in Taylor's death, he remarked, quote, "The decision before my office as the special prosecutor in this case was not decided if the loss of Miss Taylor's life was a tragedy. The answer to that is unequivocally yes." He added, "I understand that Breonna Taylor's death is part of a national story, but the facts and evidence in this case are different than others involving police shootings," he said. "If we simply act on emotion or outrage, there is no justice," said Cameron. "Mob justice is not justice. Justice sought by violence is not justice. It just becomes revenge." He added that the FBI is still investigating potential violations of federal law in the case. A Republican, you'll be shocked to learn, Cameron is the state's first black state attorney general. He's also a protege of Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, the Kentucky senator facing re-election in November against Democratic former fighter pilot Amy McGrath. Taylor was shot multiple times by officers who entered her home, reportedly using a no-knock warrant during a narcotics investigation, even though the AG denies a no-knock warrant was used. The warrant used to search her home was connected to a suspect who did not live there. And the use of no-knock warrants have since been banned by Louisville's Metro Council. Before any charges were brought, Hankison was fired from the city's police department back in June. A termination letter sent to him by the interim Louisville police chief said the white officer had violated procedures by showing, quote, "extreme indifference to the value of human life," when he, quote, "wantonly and blindly shot 10 rounds of gunfire into Taylor's apartment in March." Hankinson, Sergeant Jonathan Mattingly, officers Miles Cosgrove, and the detective who sought the warrant, Joshua Janes, were placed on administrative reassignment after the shooting. Taylor's boyfriend, Kenneth Walker, opened fire when police burst in. He hit Officer Mattingly, but Walker was the one who was charged with attempted murder of a police officer. After protests, prosecutors later dropped that charge. That came very quickly. On September 15, the city settled, this is just last week, a lawsuit against the three officers that was brought by Taylor's mother. They agreed to pay $12 million and enact police reforms. Well, actually, the officers did not. The city did. So they agreed to pay her $12 million and enact police reforms. By the way, that's $12 million in taxpayer money. But really, why would they do that? For what? Apparently, the cops that work for the city, they did nothing wrong to her, according to the attorney general. In any event, that news breaks today, and I'm hoping that everyone stays safe if they head out to march in protest tonight or over the next few days. I hope that they do not play into Donald Trump's hands. I also hope, especially, that they are careful of right-wing saboteurs out there who will almost certainly be out there hoping to inflame peaceful protests in this case.
Yes, as we saw with the George Floyd protests and protests across the country, provocateurs, right-wing provocateurs, are out there and ready to light a match anywhere they can get away with it.
Hi, Desi Doyen.
Hi.
In other law enforcement news, sorta, which may have an effect on our now officially ongoing presidential election, as voters are now beginning to vote early and by mail all over the country. In fact, given the twisted, politicized state of our federal law enforcement and intelligence agencies, I am not really sure yet what to make, Desi Doyen, of this story, but it does seem worth sharing today, so I will, as covered by NBC News last night. Americans, they report, should look to state election officials for trusted results in November, the FBI said on Tuesday, as bad actors may try to sow chaos while votes are still being counted. In a public service announcement, the FBI and the U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, Yes, it's actually described at the top of this thing as a public service announcement. The FBI cautions that certifying the results of the U.S. elections could take weeks and that, quote, foreign actors and cyber criminals could exploit the time required to certify and announce 2020 election results. Foreign actors and cyber criminals, they warn, could create new websites, change existing websites, and create or share corresponding social media content to spread false information in an attempt to discredit the electoral process and undermine confidence in U.S. democratic institutions. As many problems as we have, now you can add this to the list. They go on to say state and local officials typically require several days to weeks to certify elections' final results in order to ensure every legally cast vote is accurately counted. The increased use of mail-in ballots due to COVID-19 protocols could leave officials with incomplete results on election night. Well, I'm glad at least they're offering that public service announcement. They go on to say foreign actors and cyber criminals could exploit the time required to certify and announce election results by disseminating disinformation that includes reports of voter suppression, cyber attacks targeting election infrastructure, or voter or ballot fraud, and other problems intended to convince the public of the election's illegitimacy. The FBI and CISA urge the American public to critically evaluate the sources of the information they consume and to seek out reliable and verified information from trusted sources such as state and local election officials. They don't mention federal officials there.
Gosh, I wonder why.
I don't know. I really don't know. Make of this what you will. The public, they say, should also be aware that if foreign actors or cyber criminals, presumably that includes domestic actors, don't know, if they were able to successfully change an election-related website, the underlying data and internal systems would remain uncompromised, they say. Okie dokie, then. Where to start on this? I don't know that in such an event, the underlying data and internal systems would remain uncompromised. Yes, if bad guys are able to change an election reporting site, like a Secretary of State's site or the New York Times results site, something like that. In other words, if they were able to just change the numbers on the public-facing website that people are able to read, those could be changed without changing the underlying data. It would end up in chaos, I suspect. It would end up in, if they showed Donald Trump winning when he really wasn't, it would end up in, I'm sure, him declaring that he won because such and such a website said so. That could be done without changing the actual vote count. Of course, the fact is that changing the underlying vote count itself via computerized tabulators, that is not, in fact, very difficult at all. And it can be done in a way that would be virtually impossible for anyone to notice unless they bothered to hand count at least the hand-marked paper ballots that are available, where they are available. That, as listeners to this program or readers to bradblog.com know from our reporting over the last 17 years or so, is rarely done. It is very rare that they bother to actually hand count hand-marked paper ballots, or any ballots for that matter. Not even in some of the very closest and most surprising elections, like the 2016 elections, where had just two votes been recorded for Hillary Clinton instead of Donald Trump in each precinct in three battleground states, Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania, all of which flipped to the Republican candidate that year for the first time in decades. Well, if that had happened, Hillary Clinton would have been the president right now and not Donald Trump. But even in that case, attempts to hand count hand-marked paper ballots in those three states was blocked largely by Republicans, though Democrats were not very helpful either. In Pennsylvania, of course, there was not much to hand count, given that the state back in 2016 forced most voters to vote on 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting system. So even if a hand count would have been allowed in Pennsylvania back then, there's no way to know that the old, in some cases, two decades old computer systems that voters were forced to use in 2016, that any of them actually reflected the intent of the voters. on those touchscreen computer voting systems. It was 100% impossible to know if any vote actually cast on one of them reflected the intent of any voter that year. Well, now the good news in Pennsylvania, which seems to be shaping up of late as a perhaps the potential tipping point, the swing tipping point swing state for 2020, Pennsylvania. The good news is that the Democratic governor there ordered new voting systems after the 2016 election. The bad news is that about a third of the state's counties, including its largest and most Democratic-leaning metropolitan area, Philadelphia, replaced their old 100% unverifiable touchscreens with brand new 100% unverifiable touchscreens. Some slightly better news is that the state also enacted no-excuse absentee mail-in voting last year, so there'll be a lot more hand-counted paper ballots to tally this year, ballots that actually tell us how voters voted.
I think you mean hand-marked, not hand-counted.
Hand-marked, right. Hand-marked paper ballots that can be hand-counted. Still, the unverifiable touchscreens remain 100% unverifiable where they are used, and there's likely to be enough voters voting on them this year to tilt the balance of the state one way or another. Oddly enough, while the state's Democratic Secretary of State, Kathy Buchvar, is currently defending the use of those machines in court, she's now being joined in that defense by the Trump campaign, who is taking her side in that legal battle. Now, why would they do that, as they are otherwise suing the state over the use of absentee mail-in ballots and the use of drop boxes for those ballots and so forth? Well, we'll be joined shortly here by investigative journalist Art Levine. He has an in-depth story just breaking today on exactly that. It was published at Washington Monthly. It is headlined, quote, "Donald Trump's favorite voting machines, ballot marking devices in key swing states that could give him the perfect excuse to contest the election." As Art's story explains, and as we've been yelling and screaming about here for years, so I'm glad that someone finally noticed, similar machines will not only be used in battleground Pennsylvania, but also battleground states like North Carolina, Ohio, Texas, and Georgia. And yes, Democrats seem to be supporting the use of those systems in those states. And as we've long reported, even here in California, in the largest county in the state, largest county in the nation, actually, Los Angeles, where we have just installed 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, which, like the ones in Pennsylvania and Georgia during the primaries this year, they failed spectacularly. Anyway, going back to this FBI and Infrastructure Security Agency public service announcement, it includes, as I said, some recommendations along with, somewhat opaque warnings, you know, that we should seek out trustworthy sources such as state and local election officials, verify who produced the content and so forth, verify through multiple sources any reports about problems in voting or election results. So, again, generally useful information, I guess. The government warning does not cite domestic actors as potential sources of disinformation for whatever reason, despite evidence of at least one domestic troll farm here in the U.S. in the style of Russia's Internet Research Agency that you'll recall causing trouble ahead of the 2016 election. This domestic group was recently reported by the Washington Post, after which Twitter subsequently banned a bunch of accounts from what appear to be this use of domestic bots tweeting out support of Donald Trump. But the warning points specifically to state and local election officials as trustworthy. It does not mention federal officials. As you know, Donald Trump has repeatedly made false claims about voting by mail to indicate that it is an invalid process, particularly regarding states with Democratic election chiefs like Colorado and Michigan, and yes, even Pennsylvania. So make of it what you will. For now, just putting it out there, it's sad that we no longer know whether we can trust notices like this from the federal government, from an agency? Is it one of them that has been politicized or not? Who knows? In any event, when it comes to places like Pennsylvania, well, that's where we will head next with journalist Art Levine. He joins the fray in with his own warnings, which are certain to be ignored, like so many of ours, about the new voting systems now set for use in battlegrounds like Ohio, North Carolina, Texas, and yes, Pennsylvania. Art Levine on Donald Trump's favorite voting machines. That's next on the broadcast. Buckle up. I'm Brad Friedman. Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. You know, Donald Trump is said to have won Pennsylvania for the first time in decades in 2016 by fewer than 65,000, fewer than 65,000 votes that year. Speaking of Pennsylvania, in a sign of how critical the Keystone State is regarded by the Republican Party's election litigation strategy this year, the state GOP now wants the U.S. Supreme Court to review a state case that opened up absentee voting there, while the Trump campaign is seeking to revive a federal lawsuit targeting Pennsylvania's plans for pandemic voting. Now, you may recall we reported in some detail last week on this show before the death of Ruth Bader Ginsburg upended our coverage in recent days. We reported the mostly good news from the Pennsylvania State Supreme Court, which approved the use of absentee ballot drop boxes in Pennsylvania and is allowing ballots received by election officials to be tallied if they arrive as late as 3 days after Election Day. Now, that was a setback for Team Trump in the state court's series of rulings last Thursday. Also, those rulings included upholding a state requirement that poll watchers must live in the county where they are poll watching. That disallows Team Trump to bring in so-called ballot security squad goons from elsewhere in the, elsewhere in the state, elsewhere in the country, to come in and intimidate voters at the polls. But the indications this week from Republicans that the U.S. Supreme Court will now be asked to get involved in the state court case that we talked about last week, well, that marks the first time that the high court's intervention will be sought since the death of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. The Pennsylvania GOP, as well as the Republican leaders of its legislature, indicated on Tuesday that they would appeal the decision from the state Supreme Court last week, and particularly its extension for the receipt deadline for absentee ballots. They're going to appeal that to the U.S. Supreme Court. The notice came in requests to the state Supreme Court that it pretty please put its opinion on hold while the U.S. Supreme Court reviews the case. Tuesday's filing, first reported by The Hill, argued that the state Supreme Court's opinion violates the election clause of the U.S. Constitution by allowing ballots to be counted after Election Day, even if they lacked postmarks confirming that they were sent by then. Yes, that is an issue because the U.S. Postal Service does not always use a postmark, believe it or not, on all election mailings. So even if an absentee ballot is processed by the post office 2 days before the election, but it arrives the day after the election, Republicans do not want that ballot to be counted this year. Of course, they also don't want any ballot that arrives after Election Day, even if it is postmarked, to be counted either. Democrats and Republicans have been engaging in a multi-front court battle over several aspects of Pennsylvania's absentee voting process in recent weeks. In addition to the so far, anyway, successful state lawsuit brought by Democrats that I just mentioned, which now could be overturned by the currently 5-3 U.S. Supreme Court after the death of RBG, or even a 6-3 right-wing Supreme Court after Republicans ram through their newest member to the court, potentially before Election Day. In addition to that, there's also a federal lawsuit that was filed by the Trump campaign and the RNC that takes aim at the drop boxes and the poll watcher residency requirements as well. That federal lawsuit was put on hold while the state Supreme Court decision was pending in the state case. And now the federal judge, who is a President Trump appointee, he has now begun to revive the federal case. That case also provides Republicans the opportunity to drag the U.S. Supreme Court into this fight over Pennsylvania's election system. It is continuing to request that the federal court blocks the use of, quote, unmanned ballot boxes. In other words, secure absentee ballot drop boxes like those that are used all over the country for absentee ballots. Also, that case seeks to declare unconstitutional the residency requirement for poll watchers in the state. All of this should give you some clue why Republicans are now pushing so hard to pack the U.S. Supreme Court as hard and as quickly as they can. And if you don't believe me, just listen to Vice President Mike Pence explaining on Fox News last night to crazy person Lou Dobbs why it's so important that they expedite this confirmation.
The Senate should move thoroughly, thoughtfully, and quickly and move to consideration, a hearing if needs be, and ultimately to a floor vote, because we have major issues in the country today. And Lou, with all of the talk about universal unsolicited mail-in balloting, where we see states around the country that are now extending the deadline, there is a possibility that election issues may come before the Supreme Court in the days following the election, and all the more reason why we should have 9 justices on the Supreme Court to be able to resolve any issues that may arise then or on any other matter.
Cases that may come to the U.S. Supreme Court concerning the election. Well, as you can tell, Republicans really, really want to seat someone very quickly on the court, and they are really, really focusing for some reason on Pennsylvania this year. But there may be another reason they're focused on Pennsylvania, as longtime investigative journalist Art Levine hones in on today in a detailed investigative report published by Washington Monthly this morning. Longtime listeners here and readers at bradblog.com know that we have been yelling and screaming about the brand new 100% unverifiable touchscreen ballot marking devices that have been installed over the past year or so in states around the country in the polling places, including key swing states like Pennsylvania, Georgia, Ohio, Texas, and North Carolina, as well as even here in my own home county of Los Angeles, the nation's most populous voting jurisdiction. While we have spent quite a bit of time covering things like the $300 million boondoggle of a new unverifiable touchscreen system here in LA and the new $100 million boondoggle of new unverifiable touchscreen systems forced into every county of Georgia by its Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, we've spent less time covering the boondoggle of the new unverifiable touchscreen voting systems installed in some of the largest, most Democratic-leaning counties in swing states like North Carolina and Pennsylvania, where voters in Philadelphia, for example, will be forced to vote on these systems at the precincts this November 3rd. And while I'm not surprised to see folks like Georgia's Raffensperger forcing the use of these type of machines on voters at the polls, these so-called ballot marking devices or BMDs that use a computer to print a computer-marked paper ballot, it is maddening to see Democratic-controlled jurisdictions forcing the use of these same unverifiable systems in places like Los Angeles and Philadelphia. It's even more maddening to see some of the otherwise best voting rights and election security groups in the country, like Verified Voting and the Brennan Center, not only not objecting to the use of these unverifiable BMD systems, but in some cases actually supporting them. Well, there has been a handful of folks like myself and frequent guests on this program, like Marilyn Marks of the Coalition for Good Governance. They're suing to block the use of those machines in Georgia. They're hoping to force the use of verifiable hand-marked paper ballots at the polls instead. And other folks, computer science and security experts like Rich DeMillo of Georgia Tech, Philip Stark of UC Berkeley, and a few activists like Jenny Cohn of Protect Our Votes, Emily Levy of Scrutineers.org, Lulu Freistadt of SmartElections.us. They've all been trying to ring the alarm frequently on this show, and sometimes only on this show, because few in the mainstream corporate media have noticed this concern, or at least have bothered to report on it. To report on the danger of these voting systems that could culminate in election results that nobody can know after the election if they are accurate or not. Well, today, Art Levine picks up the ball himself, thankfully, at Washington Monthly in a lengthy piece headlined Donald Trump's Favorite Voting Machines. Ballot marking devices in key swing states could give him the perfect excuse to contest the election. Wherein Art details the fights against BMDs in several states, but especially in Pennsylvania, where the Trump campaign is actually joining forces with the Democratic Secretary of State there, Kathy Buchvar, to defend the use of 100% unverifiable touchscreen voting systems in several of the state's largest and most Democratic-leaning jurisdictions, including Philadelphia, where there are easily enough votes in Philadelphia alone to swing a state which went to Trump for the first time in decades by just over 40,000 votes out of some 6 million cast back in 2016. In addition to reporting on concerns about voting systems going back years, Art Levine is also the author of the book Mental Health, Inc., How Corruption, Lack Oversight, and Failed Reforms Endangered Our Most Vulnerable Citizens, and he's author of the Newsweek cover story that accompanied that book's publication. So I'm very happy to have him back on the voting system beat just in time for this year's election disaster. Mr. Levine, it's been a long time, but welcome back to the broadcast, sir.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the long introduction, and I hope I can shed further light on the tangled, unbelievable, nutty mess in Philadelphia that is emblematic of the kind of challenges that other swing states, statewide in Georgia and in some key Democratic cities in Ohio, Texas, and North Carolina, and so on, will be facing. It's a nightmare beyond the already other nightmares that we're aware of. It's basically the added kindling for the constitutional crisis that you profiled in terms of the Transition Integrity Project, where, you know, how likely challenges will be and refusals to concede if Trump doesn't win on election night.
There are all sorts of ways that this entire election could become just, I don't know, I don't want to call it a disaster, but an absolute mess. There's all sorts of ways for Donald Trump to challenge this election, to challenge the results. And I do want to, you know, point folks towards your long, important, excellently detailed story at Washington Monthly this just out this morning, because it details an aspect of this that is not yet being covered really anywhere in the media. Now, I will link to that story, of course, when I post today's show at bradblog.com. But I guess, Art, I should offer some full disclosure here. I did speak with you on a number of occasions in recent months as you were working on this project. So I just want to make that clear by way of disclosure. But in brief, what are your concerns about these ballot marking devices, these touchscreen BMDs being installed around the country?
Here's what my biggest concern is, and why my article is geared towards mainstream Democrats and mainstream liberal pundits and the punditocracy and media people who haven't been really paying any attention to election security for, I don't know, nearly 20 years.
Right.
So the issue that I'm trying to highlight is, particularly in this political environment, we can't know the results. The results cannot, because it's computer printouts that can't be reliably audited, verified, or proven as valid. They, as was pointed out in research papers by co-authored by experts like Philip Stark and DeMillo, who you featured on your show, you can't either challenge the results in any meaningful way, and you can't prove that they're valid. So it's basically a wide-open opportunity for chaos, doubt, and propaganda, and so on. And the Republicans, in my view, have the upper hand here because they've already signaled they're going to challenge every possible result as rigged. In contrast, the Democrats, as Jenny Cohen has pointed out in a great interview she gave Gaslit Nation, Democrats are sort of in a bind because if the machine results come in showing that they're losing in these swing states built around BMD results statewide in Georgia and all the key Democratic urban areas in these other battleground states, they have previously claimed, oh, our systems are very secure and they can't be hacked, and so they're going to risk looking like hypocrites if they challenge the BMD results. And they've been absolutely radio silent, except for Ohio Democrats, at the state and national level about the risks of voting technology. And they've been radio silent about it from the moment the Iowa app crashed through the L.A. County disaster that you chronicled so well, through the Georgia primary. They have not addressed directly head-on the fact that these are unverifiable and unreliable. And in fact, the mainstream liberal centrist solution for these problems is, oh, please just supply more junky, failure-prone, unverifiable BMDs to minority districts, and that will somehow magically reduce lines.
Now, let me jump in here to say that when these machines fail, when they just don't work, or the electronic poll books that are needed to work with them at the polling place, when they don't work, when they fail for whatever reason, they're misprogrammed, they certainly can be hacked, the internet can slow down, all of that. We see these huge lines around the block. It takes hours for people to vote. We saw that here in Los Angeles during the primary. We saw it in minority districts in Georgia during the primaries. So that could just prevent people from voting. But specifically, so people understand, these machines that print out, use a touchscreen, and then they print out what is supposed to be a copy of your selections on a piece of paper, election officials will say, well, there it is, right there. It's verifiable. What do you mean it's not verifiable? Can you explain why those ballots after an election, why nobody can know whether they reflect the intent of the voter or not?
Right. And you featured and highlighted. Yeah. One is the most recent research. First of all, they're not actually verifiable by the voters in the real world because there was a very important study out of the University of Michigan and Professor Halderman and others, and what they found is when they ran these elections and mocked, when they fiddled with the results and, created mistakes as part of the test, 93% of the people voting couldn't tell that their ballots had been monkeyed with and got different results. And less than half even bothered to check the whole thing. So one of the things that's not well understood, and I'm trying to do this in this piece, is if every single element, as you just sort of outlined, if every single element works perfectly, everything boots up, everybody is trained, it runs smoothly, it's still useless to either prove an election result or to challenge an election result. And in this environment, it is a recipe for chaos and refusal to concede. especially from the Republicans.
Now, it's useless, as you describe it. I don't want to call it useless. I will call it unverifiable, but largely for two reasons that you talk about. One is that even if people do try to verify the computer-printed results on their selections on their ballot, as you note, 93% of the people don't notice when the vote has flipped. But more to the point, even if everything works correctly, we can't know after the election if anybody actually bothered to verify those selections, much less having done so accurately. And then even making things worse, as you note, even if they do verify the English, the language, the human readable language that's printed out, that is not even what is used for tabulating the results. They use the little barcode or the QR code.
Absolutely.
That is also printed on the ballot.
Yes, that's the right. That is the thing. So even if people actually checked in some magical alternative universe, if 100% of the people checked their printouts and gave some up, yep, that's how I voted, even down to the down ballot races and the city council, yep, it's great, that's what I meant, 100%, you still don't know that's what is being scanned, because it's an unreadable QR code or an unreadable scanning code. Mm-hmm. And this is going to be, like we say in the article, this is going to make the Florida debate over hanging Chads look like child's play.
This
is a massive constitutional crisis and going to be fomented in every one of these states that use this equipment. And the Democratic Party have been silent. Now, on the positive side, I'll be glad to talk to you about some reform groups and efforts that are going on to try to reverse this, that people could try to get involved in, where they can learn more.
We'll get to that. But in reporting on this story, what is the reason that you heard that so many of these jurisdictions seem to be sticking with these systems despite the known failures, despite, when they were tried out for the first time this year, they failed spectacularly in Georgia, Pennsylvania, Los Angeles? What's the reason that election officials are sticking with them despite the known failures?
Well, it's a little hard to decipher the actual reasons, because my efforts to get comment from, for instance, Bookvar's office, the Georgia Democratic Party, national Democratic election leaders, and Mark Elias and all the others at DNC National has been, I don't know, their justifications, they have a variety of justifications, and they're specious in various ways. So one of the justifications is they bought into the notion that, as Kathy Fang at the then head of California Common Core said, mm-hmm. oh, it's stigmatizing to disabled people to vote on a machine different than ableists who are voting on hand-marked ballots. So we don't want to put voters, language minority voters or disabled voters, on the back of the bus in terms of voting. It's an unfair stigmatizing. But
So in other words, let me just decode that a little bit, Art. So in other words, what they're saying is, instead of a system where most voters used hand-marked paper ballots at the polls, and those who needed them because they're disabled or they have language issues that they need to, that they actually need an assistive electronic device, that they can use one of those. But other than that, these folks are saying, well, that would be discriminatory to make to allow most people vote one way and disabled voters to have to use this other system. So what they're saying is everybody should use this other systems, this so-called universal BMD system.
Yeah. And oddly enough, I got on the phone the most best known advocate for disabled accessible voting machines, and he favors in the long run universal use. But for this election, John Dixon, who's the best known critic of hand marked paper ballots, said we shouldn't be introducing, this universal use system in a presidential election year. And he compared it to trying to put on a tire on a car racing down the highway. It's that crazy.
Yeah.
And so we have, so basically, you have so-called do-gooders. But then we have the other issue, which is unbelievable lobbying and corruption. And that's one of the things that I highlighted, and I drew on the reporting in the Philadelphia Inquirer, but also the advocacy work of the Philadelphia Vote Citizen Groups, Rich Gorella, that I quoted. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that happened is that he has a very plausible theory, is that basically Philadelphia, if you may have heard, has a fairly corrupt political culture,
mm-hmm.
and their judiciary is very corrupt. But what happened in Philadelphia, they actually had a guy, an actual election, they're called judges there, actual administrative supervisor, who has been sentenced to prison for actually stuffing touchscreen machines by multiple voting.
Mm-hmm.
So that, and you know, that's the culture. So what happened is in Philadelphia, according to news accounts, ES&S lobbied and hid their donations and lobbying activities and was fined $2.9 million
ES&S is the largest voting system vendor in the country. Yes,
right.
Go ahead.
And it was their kind of Rube Goldberg Express Vote XL that
mm-hmm.
literally no one who had a disability could verify their votes on. But this particular piece of junk was pushed heavily by Philadelphia City Pals. And one of them is a city councilman, has been indicted, and his protege was overseeing the election process. It's called an elected city commission. So the whole and got donations, although she has not been criminally indicted.
But they were secret. But they were secretly the people who decided to use these machines in Philadelphia were actually being lobbied with all kinds of things, special trips, money, campaign funds, everything else, I guess, from ES&S, and they weren't disclosing it. And then the group turned around and said, "Hey, you know what? Why don't we use ES&S and their crappy,
yeah, they weren't
expensive machines?"
It, and they they all gave reasons like ES&S donations, I think, and or lobbying amounted to $425,000. Now, given what you know about city politics, It is unheard of for a major election company to be fined $2.9 million for a decision-making that led to a $29 million contract in one city.
And unfortunately, it did not lead to them changing their mind about using those same systems. They're using them anyway. Art Levine, it's not just these jurisdictions, but some otherwise, you know, reliable voting groups, as well as some disability groups.
I'm highly critical of. I'm particularly critical of the Brennan Center and National Verified Voting. Now, Verified Voting, to its credit, has finally, after two of its top computer experts quit, DeMillo and Stark,
mm-hmm.
clarified that they're opposed to universal use BMDs, but they have been very ambiguous and ambivalent in their wording, although they have claimed that they haven't been ambivalent, but the evidence and track record is very clear to see. And Brennan Center, which is extremely influential on these issues, Larry Norden just told me directly, he's the head of their election security, said it's not been a priority. And instead, they've been reassuring people, don't worry about those battleground states. Almost all of them, in most places, don't have paperless DREs, which have been, you know, been going out of fashion for 20 years. But so they've been fighting a 20-year-old, you know, disappearing phantom of voting machines and not paying any attention to these machines upon which 20% of all registered voters who show up in polling places across the United States will be forced to vote on.
That
could affect the election.
Those 20-year-old DREs, as you call them, the direct recording electronic devices, those are also touchscreens. Those are the machines that were decertified recently in Georgia thanks to Marilyn Mark's lawsuit, federal lawsuit. But, yeah, so they refer to them, you know, paperless DREs. Well, now we have touchscreens that are almost exactly the same, except they print out this piece of paper, and these voting groups they seem to be cool with it. I've got just a minute or so here, Art. Let me, I want to get to something that is really key in your story at Washington Monthly and why I think it's headlined Donald Trump's favorite voting machines. This lawsuit, the NAACP, along with Free Speech for People, we had their attorney, Courtney Hostetler, on this show last week. They are actually suing against the use of these systems in Pennsylvania, in North Carolina, I think in Texas as well. In Pennsylvania, however, tell me about this suit against the use of these machines and how the Trump campaign now seems to be teaming up with the Pennsylvania, with the Democratic Pennsylvania Secretary of State, Kathy Buchvar, to defend the use of these systems.
Yeah, it's nuts. But what's happened is it's a wide-ranging lawsuit that includes touch screens and other issues like early voting and so on. It's in a state court, and basically the Trump campaign and the state and national Republican Party have intervened successfully to join with Kathy Buchvar, a Democratic Secretary of State, to fight the NAACP and other civil rights groups by going four square on behalf of these, of preventing people from using hand-marked paper ballots, and for now, even siding with the Secretary of State and not expanding the vote by mail and other accessibility issues. And they're so essentially the Trump campaign is in league with and allied with a Democratic Secretary of State, and the National Democratic Party and the State Democratic Party are accepting all of this silently and doing nothing.
It is absolutely maddening. Folks can read about it in your story. But just to make that clear, despite all of the, at the top of this segment, I went through all of the lawsuits that are going back and forth.
This is another one.
But my point is, you got Republicans and Democrats going at each other in state court, in federal court in Pennsylvania. And here, however, the Trump campaign, for some reason, is joining with the Democratic Secretary of State of Pennsylvania in this one area, in this one case. You know, Trump is against vote by mail. He's against hand-marked paper ballots. For some reason, go figure, this is okay. He's fine with unverifiable touchscreen voting systems, at least for now. Art, I've mentioned to you before, and you referred to it somewhat in your article, that if Donald Trump, after the election, comes out and makes the argument that, hey, we don't really know who won in Pennsylvania because they use these unverifiable voting machines, I'm going to have to agree with Donald Trump. And that really disturbs me, Art.
That's why it's headlined, Donald Trump's Favorite Voting Machines.
You can find that story at WashingtonMonthly.com. Art Levine is the author, longtime investigative reporter, one of the folks who years and years ago was already on this beat and telling me even back then how I was getting everything wrong. Well, now we're getting closer to the same page.
Well, I think I adjusted my views back in 2006. When I reported on this for American Prospect in the article Electric Boogaloo. So by the time the article was published, I was in line with your views.
All right. Well, they all come around eventually. Glad you did, Art. You can also find him on the Twitters at ArtL7. ArtL7 on the Twitters. Hey, thank you, brother. Really appreciate your work here. And stay in touch as this potential disaster moves forward.
Thank you so much, Brad.
You bet. You know, I talked to Art this morning, and yeah. I said, because it's a really lengthy, detailed piece. It's an excellent piece. And I said, you know what? Even though it's well reported and you're sending up this flare, this alarm, nobody's going to care. They don't care until after the election, in which case, Art, you may become the most famous person in the world. And he said, I hope not.
I agree with Art. Please, no.
Yes, I hope nobody ever has a need to go back and look at this article after the election. I fear they might.
Yeah.
Okay, quick break, and we're back with something. Yeah, I know we're running late,
we'll
aren't
see.
We? You'll save us, Desi Doyen. Okay. I'm Brad Friedman, and this is your Bradcast.
I'm riding in your car.
Welcome back to the broadcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Well, if you're going to be riding in my car out here in California, apparently it's going to have to be an electric car. Desi Doyen, just before showtime here today, California to require all new cars to be zero emission by 2035?
Yeah,
really?
Now, of course, it's for all new cars. But yes, California Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, today called for California to ban new gasoline-fueled vehicles within 15 years. That's 2035 to combat climate change and make the state the first in the nation to stop sales of cars using internal combustion engines.
Wow, that's kind of big news.
Yes, it's a big executive order. It directs the state air regulators, the California Air Resources Board, to establish regulations that will require all new cars and passenger trucks sold in California to be zero emissions vehicles. This is going to affect fossil fuel jobs, of course, and other industry related jobs. But the Democrats have a plan for that. Part of it nationally would be in the Green New Deal. But California is also working toward a just transition for fossil fuel workers there as well.
Donald Trump is not going to like it. The oil industry is not going to like
it. No, they'll fight it tooth and nail.
The car industry. The auto industry may not like it because they sell a lot of car parts for the crappy ICE vehicles, internal combustion engine vehicles, that they don't sell with electric cars, which just kind of work better.
Of course, but remember that California has signed a special deal with four major automakers. They will agree to California's new standards. So I think the industry is moving this direction. It's pretty much all over but the shouting.
Very cool. Big news. What happens in California affects the entire nation.
Yeah.
So this will be fun. I'm sure we'll have more on tomorrow's Green News Report with Desi Doyen. Until then, my thanks to Desi and to my guest today, Art Levine. Check out his story at WashingtonMonthly.com on Donald Trump's favorite voting machines. And my thanks to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's show, download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. Share it with your friends, family, and enemies. That is a service made possible by those of you who help us out. And thank you for stopping by bradblog.com/donate. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com. And you'll find me on the Facebooks and the Twitters at The Brad Blog. We'll see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. Kisses like